Well, good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. This morning in the first hour of the show, we're doing something unlike the shows that we do all the rest of the time, but something that when we have the chance to do it, it's exciting and it's fun for us, and we say, yes, let's do something a little bit different. We're coming to you from our performance studio here in Campbell Hall, and this morning we have a live in-studio concert for you. We have as our guests Voretsky Pass. It's a trio of musicians that do klezmer music, and if you don't know what that is, well, we'll tell you all about it and we'll give you a sampling. We'll give you an opportunity to hear music. They'll talk a little bit about the music and where it comes from and how they came to it and talk about themselves. And I'm sure that you will have a good time. They are here visiting the campus of the University of Illinois. There will be a couple of events. Maybe I'll just mention right here at the beginning, they'll be doing an interactive klezmer workshop on, the 19th. I guess that would be today, this afternoon at 4 o'clock in the auditorium of the Spurlock Museum. And then tomorrow, they'll be giving a concert in Smith Music Hall on the U of I quad. It's free. That's tomorrow night at 7:30. So anybody who is interested in hearing them should stop by. And to the three of you, Cookie Segelstein, Joshua Horowitz, and Stu Brotman, thanks very much.
Thank you for having us.
We appreciate being here. Just right from the beginning, I would just ask you to play something. Let's start off with some music, and then we can talk.
Great.
So tell us about that piece.
Well, that's going to tell you a little bit about the music, because that is a hodgepodge of many different styles, origins, and all put together to function in a form that would work for a dance of that beat. Mm-hmm. So we would call that a medium-fast dance.
Okay. And this is pretty much all dance music. Is it really pretty much all dance music?
No, there are a lot of things that we play that are listening as well. There are things that would be played at the table, the banquet of a wedding, for instance, but things that we kind of take those forms, the listening forms, and turn them into
other hodgepodges, like Cookie said, of, there are doinas that are meant to put the listener into a mood, into a melancholy mood or a pensive mood, and some that are there to bring the bride to cry. And we'll just take those and kind of take off on them and make improvisations on them ourselves. So we do play listening things.
Yeah. Well, I want to give the chance to have the chance here to talk to each of you a little bit so that people get a sense of what your background is. And maybe I'll start with Cookie. She has a master's degree in viola from mm-hmm. the Yale School of Music, right. Principal violist in the Orchestra New England, mm-hmm. assistant principal in the New Haven Symphony, mm-hmm. founder, director of Wretzky Pass. She has also, as I think all of them have, has played in different groups, different places, given workshops and talked about, done a lot of talking about the music. Right. You're probably a natural one to ask about the name of the group, because it's a place, and this is the place where your family comes from?
My father was born at the base of the pass in a town called Nizhnye Veretsky, which means upper Veretsky, which was lower than lower Veretsky, which south of lower Veretsky.
Upper Veretsky is south of lower Veretsky.
Yeah, I think it had to do with geography. I think it was a mountain of the elevation.
Army maps, you know, those traveling armies, they turn the map upside down and invade their own country. You never
know. Right. They get all mixed up. So he was born in this tiny town, and my mother was born not far from there in the town of Munkach or Mukachevo. It's all now Ukraine, but at the time of my father's birth, I believe it was had just become Czechoslovakia. It was Austria-Hungary. And that mountain pass was crucial also for the settling of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. Prince Arpad came through there in, I think, 894 AD and settled the Magyars, or as it's spelled, Magyars, in Munkach or Mukachevo, which means, I think, castle on a hill. And so they settled and became the Austro-Hungarian Empire. But Jews traversed through there for over 200 or 300 years, and my family was actually in Nizhny Veretsky for a couple of hundred years, as far as we know. And the musically, the interesting thing about that area is that it was such a mix of ethnicities. There were Ukrainians, there were Hutsul people, which were Ukrainian people of the mountains. There were Ruthenians, there were Russians, there were ethnic Germans, there were Poles, Hungarians, lots of Gypsies. And so it was a real musical hodgepodge. So, eventually that's what drew me to that area. And we were kind of batting around the name of a trio, and we kind of just settled on that one just because, you know, we just wanted to stop arguing about naming the group. So,
it's not usual for a viola to be a soloist.
This is a violin. Instrument.
Oh, that is a violin.
Oh, yeah. I play viola classically. I do play viola in this music, in our last record, which is the one that's out. Our new one is still in the process of being mixed. But there is a viola suite, a viola bass duet in there, of all things. But viola is my classical instrument. Violin is my folk instrument, pretty much.
I know violas, they grumble a lot about getting no respect. And, you know, there aren't that many viola concertos. And
But they're really good. The ones that are there.
Well, is there actually a big difference technically between playing the two instruments?
Well, the viola is much bigger, and there's no standard size for viola. With violin, there's pretty much a standard size, even though my violin is probably a Bohemian, and it's a little bit big, which gives it a darker sound, and a lot of folk fiddlers like that, and will like, it's a copy of a Magini violin. It's by no means a Magini. I'd be wearing a whole different set of outfit if I could afford a Magini, but the folk fiddlers do like the bigger, deep sound. So the viola is bigger and more cumbersome to play fast. And also the projection is not really for a group that has to play and be heard in dancing and, you know, in many cases acoustically, and of course in history only acoustically, it had to be able to cut through. And viola was used and is used for chords in this kind of setup.
All right. I'll move around here and I'll take the chance to talk to everybody. But before doing that, let's have some more music. I don't want to do lots of talking here. I also want to give the opportunity for you to play and for people to hear music. So how about giving
how
something
about a
else?
Little? How about just the hora after the doina, just that hora there? Okay.
Joshua Horowitz is saying, what? Which piece was that? What
have we done? So many of them. Thank you.
Gretzky Pass here playing in our performance studio here in Campbell Hall this morning. And if you've just tuned in, you're wondering, is this in fact Focus 580? Yes, it is Focus 580, but we're doing something different this morning, giving you a chance to hear some of this music and hear from the musicians. And also, in this first hour of the show, we're not taking phone calls as we usually do. That would just be far too complicated. It's enough to be doing what we're here doing this morning. And our guests are Cookie Sigelstein. She is playing the violin. Joshua Horowitz, who is playing accordion, and Stu Brotman is playing what looks like a cello, what I guess is a cello, but it's set up in an unusual way.
Cello doing business as bass. I'm a bass player, and I got excited when I found out that you can carry around a cello and tune it in a way that makes it fun to play as a bass, but you can actually get it onto an airplane without a big fight.
So I see now it does have four strings, but there are two of the strings that are paired up very closely together. So you actually, is it kind of like a three-string, sort of like a three-stringed instrument?
Yeah, it's set up as a three-string bass. It's rather common still in Eastern Europe to play three-string basses, which may go back to the days when there were more sizes of basses than there are now commonly in use. I have a bass from 1822 that's originally built as a three-string instrument. It's about two-thirds the size of a contemporary bass. On a smaller instrument, they just don't play, they don't use the lowest note that's now common on bass, a low E. They have a G and a D and an A. And that's still done on Hungarian and Polish and Ukraine and Czech basses and Romanian very, very frequently, especially the farther into the less urban centers. But this particular instrument is my modification of a Polish mountain tuning in which the cello has a D string, one note above the lowest note that's usually on a cello, a C, and two A strings below and above, which are played together as a pair. Played that for a while, and I liked it, but then I found that it was such a worthwhile instrument to play in this band. It traveled well and sounded good that I wanted to add an extra G string above to make it work as a three-string bass. So now I have A, D, and G.
Okay. If that's clear to you all at home, that's good. You're actually wearing this. You have a strap that you're wearing over your shoulder. I understand that actually sometimes groups, when they play this kind of music, they actually walk around. And so whoever was playing that instrument would actually have to walk and wear it and carry
sure.
it.
In small villages in Eastern Europe, a wedding, weather permitting, would often have a lot of the activities outside. And the musicians would, in fact, frequently lead or follow processions to gather people for a wedding. And even full-size basses are sometimes strapped on a strap just under the fingerboard where the neck meets the body and then connected to the other end at the bottom around where the end pin connects. And it's just as comfortable to wear, if you have a good back, as a guitar. And cello is even more frequently done that way. And that's also part of the Polish mountain tradition that I modeled this instrument after.
Mm-hmm. Just, again, a little bit more about Stu Brotman. He's been working in the field of ethnic music for a long time, more than 35 years. He has a bachelor's degree in music from University of California, Los Angeles, and has also done performing in pop music settings. He's this is really interesting. You toured and recorded with Canned Heat. Is that right?
Yeah. I was in the band that became Canned Heat. We already had the name Canned Heat, but we took off for the summer. We were all at school at UCLA, and work wasn't coming in yet. We didn't have a record contract. A few of the guys took jobs out of town. I took a job with an Armenian belly dance band in Fresno. And it was a union job, and when they called from L.A. and said, hey, we've got a record contract to sign tomorrow, can you be here? The band leader said, I'll have you blackballed. You're not going to work again if you leave with less than 2 weeks' notice. And that was the end of my Canned Heat career and the beginning of their recording career.
Oh, well, their loss. Also here with us is Joshua Horowitz. He has a master's degree in composition and music theory from the Academy of Music in Graz, Austria, where he taught music theory. He also served as research fellow and director of the Klezmer Music Research Project for 8 years, and has all the members performed in different settings and different groups and so forth. How did you come to this music?
Yeah. Well, I don't belly dance as well as Stu does, but when I was living in Austria, there was sort of a rash of anti-Semitism that happened while the Waldheim affair was going on. And I was living in Austria. I lived there for 17 years. And at that time, I realized that there were very few people playing Jewish music in and around Austria and Germany, in German-speaking countries. So I decided to start researching the music from that, from Graz out and going to Eastern Europe, and developed a research program at the university to be able to do it. And started gathering a lot of materials then and playing in different groups that I formed. Went from there. And when I finally came back, Stu and I had played actually about 12 years ago in his other band, Brave Old World, which is quite well known. And Cookie and I met in Albuquerque in the year 2001. And that's when we started playing together. And since we had all known each other, we formed a group together. But that was the basis, was living in Austria and kind of getting in touch with, you know, questions of my own identity and all that.
And your instrument, you're playing an accordion, and this is a, I guess you would call that a button accordion?
Yeah.
Because it doesn't have, some accordions, people have this idea of the accordion, it looks like it has keys like on a piano.
Right.
But this does not.
I thought he meant zippers.
The rare zipper accordion.
The zipper accordion.
Is not being pictured.
I'm sure it's been done. But, this accordion is from 1889, which for an accordion is really old. For a violin, it wouldn't be as old, because the accordion has really only been around in this form since about the 1830s. And it is a button, of course, a chromatic button accordion. That means it has all the notes that you have on a piano, but they're little buttons that you push. And it's the predecessor of what's now called the Russian Bayan. The Russians took over this system, of this arrangement of the buttons, and created a type of accordion that's commonly used all throughout Russia, yeah. Russian countries.
There, on the CD, there's a lovely solo piece that I would love to hear you play, and it would be an example of a different – you were talking earlier about the fact that sometimes – yes, there is dance music, but then there are other kinds of pieces that you play that are intended to encourage different kinds of moods.
Yeah.
And I wondered if you would
– Sure. Well, I won't play the one that's on the CD.
Oh, okay.
I'll play a different one since they're always first-time things.
It'll be on the next – new-released CD.
Right. Some kind of form of it.
Okay.
Thank you. So tell us a little bit about the piece.
What can I say? I just played it.
You wrote it.
He wrote it.
But we didn't write it down. In the tradition of Stu's explanation about the cello, I will say that it's different from other pieces that are the same as pieces that are different than it, but the same as those that are the same of the other ones that are different from it.
Well, it couldn't be more clear. Thank you very much.
Sure.
Yes, it could.
it couldn't if he was saying it.
And in addition to playing the accordion, you also play hammered dulcimer. At least that's what I would call it.
Yeah. Yeah, we call it a kosher egg slicer. It's a large trapezoid-shaped instrument, and it has a pedal on it. And in Yiddish, it's called a tzimbel. In Hungarian and Romanian, they call it cymbalum. It's an old instrument. I mean, this one's made about 15 years ago on the basis of some older tunings that I combined together in my own design. But it's you hit it with wooden hammers. In most of Eastern Europe, with those wound with cotton, but mine are wood or wood with leather on them. And it's like if you put a harp sideways and hit the strings on it, it would be kind of like that sound. Yeah. Predecessor of the piano, by the way.
Yeah. Well, I guess it's sort of the same principle. It's a string, an open string that you hit with something, and when you play the piano, you press the key down, a little hammer hits it, and this is just a more direct kind of way.
That's right, before the big mechanism.
Yeah. Our guest here this morning in the studio, Voretsky Pass. The last guy you heard, that's Joshua Horowitz, and then before that, Stuart Bruttman, and also Cookie Sigelstein. And they are here in Champaign-Urbana visiting. They'll be talking about their music. They'll be doing an interactive klezmer workshop at the Spurlock Museum Auditorium this afternoon at 4. And they will be giving a concert. This is a free concert tomorrow night at 7:30 in Smith Music Hall on the U of I Quad. So anyone who is interested in attending should certainly feel welcome. And they do have CDs available also if you are interested in having their music in your home. You can go out to wherever it is you buy your music and do that. And just this is Focus 580. Yes, it is. We're live here in our performance studio, not taking calls in this first hour of the show, but back in doing our more usual thing for hour number two. Maybe you could talk, some of you, all of you, any of you, could talk a little bit more about how it is you find the music, where the music comes from, because I'm sure you can't go down to the music store and buy sheet music like this. Where do you find it?
Well, a lot of different places. You know, as you mentioned, we all play in other groups too, and each of those groups and all of the aspects of people approaching this music have. Some have the same focus, some have different focus. In Stu's group, Brave Old World, they have a singer, Michael Alpert, who's wonderful and does a lot of recreations of pre-World War II sounds. And in the Lodge Ghetto program is something that they've worked on that's very wonderful. And Josh is the leader of Budavitz, which I also play in, which is a group made up of three guys from Budapest, one guy from Berlin, and the two of us. And I also play with Hank Sapoznik and Mark Rubin in the Youngers of Zion, go figure that one out, which is a banjo, a tuba, and a fiddle, which is trying to force Jewish music into an old-time American sound. So we also take, our knowledge and our exposure to different aspects of parts of this music and fan it out, I would say, in different ways. Well, these guys have incredible archives of field recordings. Stu has a recording that he stood at a wedding in Yash, Romania in 1970, was it?
1970.
A Jewish wedding in Yash, Romania, which there was a band playing, and he was with his tape recorder. And we take that tape, transfer it to CD, of course, because we can in this age, mm-hmm. and extract things that we like. And Josh also has many field recordings of when he lived in Europe and some old cassettes bought at a Romanian marketplace for $2 of, a guy and a sister playing their family party music. And we do a lot of cutting and pasting. And I grew up with these parents who expected me to entertain them with a violin and would sing to me and expect me to play it. So with all of our different exposures, Josh's compositional and theoretical knowledge, Stu's broad knowledge of many different Eastern European styles, my very specific knowledge of the region where my parents are from, we somehow come together with a sound and an ability to put it all together in... That was a long way of saying
yes.
Yes.
Do you ever get to the point where something is written down, or do you carry this all just in your head?
We carry it all in our head. We never play on the stage with music, but we do actually transcribe stuff. And Cookie, for instance, transcribed the whole last record that we played and, sell it as a book, The Music of Voretsky Pass. We've transcribed many of the songs, improvisations of old recordings, for instance, and sell those as well. And we have also, I published The Ultimate Klezmer, which is a book of 270 tunes, and also a Sephardic songbook of Sephardic music. So we've done a lot of publishing, and we do write it down, but we don't work from music. The music needs to be too flexible to be relegated to one page of music. So, but we do write it down.
So as a group, as Wretzky Pass, how many tunes do you think you know that you could all play together? Yeah, and you get just
on purpose.
One song.
Many variations like Vivaldi. One concerto 400 times.
Well, right. It's amazing you can get that much mileage out of that one tune. That's really good.
How many tunes do we know?
I haven't a clue.
I don't either. I've never tried to count them. I mean, two or three hundred
that we could actually
probably.
Yeah, that we play together.
And then sometimes things happen, combinations happen accidentally that kind of work. We kind of say that's great. And when we transcribe, you know, to sell the books to students or to people interested in seeing it written, we do it after we play it, and then we'll transcribe the skeleton. We can't transcribe our ornaments or our sense of timing.
Every time we really do different. But I think if we gathered all the different pieces that we have played, not necessarily can pull out right now, through the years between all of us, it would probably run in the thousands.
That amazes me, and I certainly do believe that. And I have heard people who play other kinds of folk music say that same thing. Well, that may be, in fact, really they, one way or another, they might know thousands of tunes.
Yeah.
And to me, that just boggles my mind. I don't know how, after a while, that they would just mush together.
They do. And there are times that we accidentally go to a B-section from something else, and, you know, we just go there. And, you know, sometimes we go, how did we get in this mode?
Right.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Well, can't get out of this tunnel.
Yeah,
you get in this vortex.
Right.
But it's a lot, you know, there are pattern similarities. You know, if you think about it, they're the sonnet form or something. You know, you could, after you've known several hundred sonnets, you'll begin to see the patterns of alliteration and this and that and all the things that are used. And it's the same thing. You see the patterns, certain patterns of tunes that come up all the time. And that's why we mix them together.
But it's just a musical culture, and you grew up in a musical culture, and you actually do know thousands of tunes. You probably know jingles and commercials and theme songs from radio and TV shows and pop music in the thousands. We have had the motivation to immerse ourselves in a number of musical cultures, so we've had to act as if we grew up in a lot of different places and absorbed stuff that our contemporaries didn't grow up with, so we play a different repertoire, but it's the same process. Jazz musicians know thousands of songs and mix and match and cut and paste in their minds, and the process of improvisation and playing with emotional push and pull in the melody and phrasing is part of the culture. It's just part of the accent that you grow up with.
Right. And we do a lot of learning on the bandstand. Like we'll play with people where we don't know the tune at all, and we'll be playing with them. And somehow we recognize the patterns, and we'll be able to. I mean, Stu, if I started playing a tune that Stu didn't know and Cookie didn't know right now, they would still be able to play with me.
Yeah. Okay.
We might look like deer in the headlights, but yeah, we'd be there.
But they can't see that on radio.
That's the beauty of radio. Yeah, there's a lot of stuff you can't see. It covers a multitude of sins.
It takes me back to the days of silent radio.
Right.
Yeah. Should we put our clothes on now?
When I started, it was black and white radio.
now it's
in color, and it makes a whole difference.
Is
huge. How about playing some more for us?
Okay.
Thank you.
That's wonderful. Well, here in studio with us this morning, the members of Voretsky Pass, playing the violin, Cookie Sigelstein, playing a bass disguised as a cello, Stu Brotman, and Joshua Horwitz playing button accordion. They're here visiting the campus of the University of Illinois. I'm going to give a free concert tomorrow night at Smith Hall. That's at 7:30. So if you'd like to hear more from them, you can stop by. And if you'd just like to hear more of their music, you go down to wherever you buy CDs, and you look for Voretsky Pass. And if they don't have it,
they won't have it, probably.
Complain strenuously, and they'll order it for you.
All of our CDs from all of our bands are available on Amazon, or goldenhorn.com carries Budovitz and Voretsky Pass, and I think Brave Old World is in Tower Records. And
yeah, and our latest, the Song of the Loved Ghetto, is on Winter in Winter, which is it should be in good distribution or orderable.
Okay. Or you can just go to our websites, too.
All of our websites, yeah.
Okay, very good. Yeah. So it is possible to get them. You may not be able to run right out and find it easily, but it is possible.
Not at a quick trip.
I'm interested in having you talk just a little bit more about where this music comes from, and that is, what are the various influences on it? Because it sounds, it doesn't really sound like anything else. You can place it. I vaguely place it in Eastern Europe,
right.
But there seem to be things that come into that music that come from all places. And it sounds Eastern, and it sounds Western, and it sounds like something from I don't know where. It's very mysterious sounding.
Well, there are elements of Romanian. Romanian styles. There are elements of Moldavian. There are elements of Ukrainian. And you're exactly right. It's Turkish, Greek, Gypsy. Jews have lived in a lot of places and have assimilated in various degrees. There were Jews in Germany that considered themselves to be Germans and not Jews. There were Jews in small villages that had no idea what the government was. So in various ways, Jews have taken part in community culture. One of those ways is cooking, and another way is music. And so basically, wherever Jews have lived, wherever Jewish musicians have met other musicians, when Constantinople became open to trade routes in, what was that, 15th, 16th century, and trade happened in all these cultures, Greeks and Jews and Turks were sharing music and trade. And so all of these elements are in the music. What makes it sound Jewish is the accent. As Stu says, we play it with a Jewish accent. And that comes from, it's like I liken it to looking at the constellation, the Pleiades, which is the seven sisters. If you look directly at it, you can only see six. If you use your peripheral vision, you can see all seven. My brother's a physicist. He taught me this. And it's the same thing with saying what makes the music Jewish. You can say what elements of it make it Jewish because, as you said, it comes from so many different – you can't put your finger on it. It sounds Turkish. It sounds Greek. It sounds Romanian. There's a little bit of L.A. Cant Heat sound in there. There's a little bit of Kansas City Prairie where I grew up. There's a little bit of Niagara Falls where he was born, all mixed with the culture that we're immersed in. It's really musicians take tunes they like and play them. And so that's kind of how we approach putting music together in this group. We have likes of a certain sound, maybe some Turkish and Romanian, and we play them our way because we've been steeped in the musical culture long enough. We've studied it so in such depth. Now we feel free not to justify, musically. What we're doing so much.
People have there are people who play klezmer and do all kinds of weird stuff with it. They take it, they push it to jazz. I'm not sure that I've ever heard any, but that there are actually people who do rap klezmer.
Oh,
or
yeah,
klezmer.
Sure,
there's hip hop. There's reggae klezmer. There's
New Orleans style.
There's New Orleans. Yeah, I mean you can. All of the music that gets mixed together are open systems anyway. They're music they take from other things. Rap will take, or hip hop will take music from. Gospel, and they'll take it from ska and this and that, and it's all in there. So all these things are in varying degrees compatible as in mixes. Some of them, I mean, we don't feel them as well. You know, I'll hear a mixture of salsa and you know, klezmer.
Same thing, slightly different accent.
But me not, we don't, it doesn't attract us. We go, nah, it doesn't really work for us. But, but you know, it was always a mishmash, like Cookie was saying. You know, if you look already back to, let's say, you know, the 1880s, the mix of Ruthenian, Ukrainian, Polish, Galician, and Bessarabian styles are there in the music, and Turkish, you know, who infiltrated the whole area. I mean, the Ottoman Empire, this is, all of these tunes basically come from the areas that were dominated by the Turks for you know, 500 years. So so there's a huge influence there, but there is also synagogue melodies. There are synagogue melodies that are in there. And gestures that we use that are from everywhere. So the mix is just a little bit of maybe of an older nature than today's, but it's still a mix.
All right. Well, here in studio with us is our Wroetzki Pass. They're here in Champaign-Urbana. They're giving a workshop this afternoon. They're giving a concert tomorrow night, and we're pleased they could be here in the studio with us to play something that we have this nice performance studio here, and we always say, wouldn't it be cool if we could do this more often, and we really don't do it very much, and so I'm really pleased that you all could be here and
great,
be with us. Well, I'd love you to play some more, so if you would, please.
Okay. Let's do the Anfara Sachaba. B flat one.
Okay.
This, you were talking earlier about finding the music and collecting it, and the fact that in Europe there are still people who are performing the music. Was there any sense in which you think that this music was in danger, though, of being lost? Or would you think that even if you weren't playing this, would there still be somebody somewhere who was playing this music?
It's been being lost for hundreds of years. Bartok and Kodály complained about it, and yes, it's true. It has diminished, definitely, but music is always still being made, and I think that people who claim that it's being lost fail to see that music is always in a culture, and it's just being evolved to the point of unrecognizability a lot of times, that people who have a desire to hear very old music will find in their own culture that they're not hearing it that much anymore. But it still is music, and the music of today is, of course, the old music of tomorrow. So, but yes, there has been a diminishing of the amount of folk music that's being made in the older styles, I would say. But
yeah, and of course, you know, with the Holocaust, we really lost so much contact with the old guys, you know, the sources. I mean, you know, people can go down into Appalachia and find an old fiddler and live with him and study with him and learn the style that he learned from his father. And that's a little more difficult, so that what we're sometimes probably calling old-style Jewish music may have nothing to do with really what was in place in the shtetls, and which means village, of Eastern Europe. I mean, I had the experience of you know, growing up playing mostly vocal music from my parents, then going to Klez camp in the Catskills and learning what I thought was klezmer. Came back home to my father and showed him what I learned. And he put his hands on his ears and he said, "Oh, God, what's that noise?" And that had nothing to do with what he recognized because mm-hmm. I had put so many ornaments on it. I was probably playing more of a Greek style. And for him, what was old-time music in his town, he said, "You'd never get a job at Veditsky. You know, you'd have to work cleaning a barn somewhere. You couldn't play the fiddle there." So, you know, I learned from that, you know, reconstructing an old style of music is difficult. And so we accept what Josh just said, that it evolves. We get elements of the old, of the antiquity, and, you know, what people remember, or at least what they think they remember, because memory is very funny. Memory is sometimes accommodates the questioner. You know, somebody says, "How did you? What was it like when you were a child?" And the source says, "What do you want me to say that it was like?" And so sometimes there's that kind of relationship that goes on.
Well, it makes me think about some of the arguments, and I'm sure the arguments are still raging within the classical music community about Baroque and
Absolutely.
Medieval music.
Absolutely.
And there it's even more difficult because there are nobody left from the Middle Ages who has heard the music, and then there are people who are saying, "Well, this is authentic. This is authentic performance style." And, of course, who knows what it sounded like.
Authentic for a poor church or for a rich church. You know, the level of performance would be so vastly different depending on where you are. It's not a monolith. People in Lübeck didn't play the same as the ones in Leipzig, you know, during Bach's time when he complained all the time about his choirs not having enough rehearsal time. Think how horribly they must have sung. And you want to put, you know, the Tabernacle Choir on something like that rehearses three times a week, and, you know, and say that's authentic. You know, I'm not bashing anybody, but it's not a monolith. It's pluralistic, the styles of any culture.
Mm-hmm. But you also have to keep in mind that Western European musical criticism and literature is a very well documented field. There are people that talked about performance practice for hundreds of years, still on paper. We can still read those sources. We don't have that. We haven't found that richness of commentary in other traditions, especially in Eastern European Jewish music. The research is difficult, but it's continuing. There are people finding literature about things not as far back as Western music, 100 to 200 years. Little bit of information from, you know, one town, one player, one person. But performance practice is, there's a lot of information on paper that makes Western European performance practice have a lot more to stand on than what we're working for. Yeah.
So what you're having to do with a lot of us is just you're having to play it the way that it feels, right?
And take our preferences, our predilections from things that we hear as current practice. We just have to hope that we're not going too far afield when we play something that's informed somewhat by what's now done in Romania, in Hungary, Slovakia, Poland, Ukraine. All these styles give us a broad vocabulary of possibilities, but we see in that real performance practice was infinitely variable from person to person, from town to town. Also, there's back porch music and then there's professional music. Gypsies and Jews in particular were a professionalized cast of musicians that had to play for a wider range of events and societies than people that just play in their small rural towns mm-hmm. without that much contact with other cultures. Shtetls were commercial towns, not small logging or farming towns, and they had to play the latest tangos and waltzes.
Mm-hmm. We have about 5 minutes or so left. We'll go just a tiny bit longer because we don't have the markets are closed today, but it's almost our regular time. I'd like to have you give you a chance to play at least one more time here. Whatever you feel like.
How about the last two? the last grand march on.
Nice.
Okay.
Retsky Pass. So just before, actually, before the show started, I was talking with the members of the group here about the fact that two of them, Cookie and
Joshua,
live in Connecticut. You both live in the same town, right?
Same house, too.
In the same house.
Same room.
Same room, too. Yeah.
Oh, please. This is a family show. I'm not sure we really want to get into that.
Yeah, and we all have thumbs for fingers.
And Stu lives in Berkeley. So how often do you all see one another, since you're all playing in different groups as well?
Well, we see each other a few times, probably 6-7 times a year. And we, since we just recorded our new record in January, and plus we've been working on Grant, we make time together. Stu came out to the East for a couple and a half weeks. His wife joined us for a little while. And when we're on tour, we try to get together a day before, run over some stuff. But, you know, we all three trust each other musically, so we can throw things out at the last minute and just kind of open the gates and let her buck kind of thing.
Oh, and that's great. Well, it sounds like, because what you were talking before about how you've played together, the feeling that you have for the music, that it sounds as if you probably could just essentially walk into the room, sit down, get the instruments out, sort of warm up, and just start playing, and you would be just fine.
Yeah.
That's right.
Or you'd think so.
Well, I would. I wouldn't know.
Until we listen to the recording of that.
Well, if nobody's watching.
are there times that you're sitting there and you're playing and the audiences say, yeah, that's having a great time, and you're thinking, oh, man, this is the worst. We have never sounded so bad.
Never.
Do you ever
never
have that
happened.
Feeling?
Never.
We,
never.
You know,
really?
we say to each other, you guys sounded great, but I sucked.
Right. Right,
I was
right.
Terrible. And then we do that round robin thing because, you know, one of us may be having trouble with our instruments or but it never really, you know, it's always tight enough that it you know, we're watching each other the whole time. We have a lot of eye contact.
The ensemble is all, I think, always sounds great, but we don't think we, as individuals,
it's personal insecurity of, you know, the
tormented artists.
And sometimes, you know, on the stage, you can't hear yourself. You can't hear so well. You know, there are acoustic situations, and because of the way that the monitors are set up, or the, you know, whatever, it's very difficult to hear. So you have to kind of base your coherence on, you know, either the bass sound or the way people are moving. I may not even be able to hear the violin sometimes. So the perspective that we have on the stage is very different from what the audience thinks.
So you'll keep our dirty little secret.
Oh, of course. I won't tell us all.
Oops.
So when you're performing on stage, are you mic'd and you do have monitors?
Sometimes.
Speakers?
You know, two nights ago in Madison, Wisconsin, we were acoustic. We love acoustic because then we can get very close together. It goes both ways. We're never, you know, as heavily mic'd as a rock band because, but, you know, sometimes we really do need, if he's playing the cymbalum, he sometimes can't hear any of us. He needs to have pretty good monitors. Mm-hmm. So.
Depends on the hall.
Yeah.
What's the biggest garage you ever played for?
2,000?
A couple thousand?
Mm-hmm. Probably.
Yeah, a couple thousand maybe. Maybe.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you figure you're going to keep on playing this and as long as you can play? As long
maybe
as you're capable of
we don't kill each other.
As long as we're supine.
Right.
You all don't fight, do you? You all don't get in arguments about the music? Ever?
No, about where we're going to stop and eat.
That's about
where
it.
I'm sick of,
musically,
I say
never.
I'm sick of Mediterranean food. If I have more hummus, someone's going to be killed. Many times we go three separate restaurants because he wants African. I just want a grilled cheese and, you know.
If it didn't die kicking and screaming, she won't eat it.
I'm tired of this vegetarian business is not for me.
Okay.
Anyway.
Well, I think we're just about at the point where we're going to have to finish up because we've almost come to the end of the time of this first hour. Focus 580. Yes, this is Focus 580. I want to say again here that our guests, Voretsky Pass, Cookie Seigelstein, Joshua Horowitz, Stu Brotman, are here visiting the campus. They will be doing an interactive klezmer workshop.